Hi, this is Amy.
And this is Andrew, and in this episode, AADL talks to Jeannie Parker.
Jeannie recalls her life at the Hill Street Commune, where she lived from the late 1960s through early 1970s, and reflects on the personalities of some of the people she lived and worked with, including Lenny Sinclair, David Sinclair, artist Gary Grimshaw, and White Panther co-founder Pun Plamondon.
My father was in the military. He was a high-ranking military Air Force officer, so I moved around the world a lot, you know, traveled a whole lot. I had promised them that I would go to a private girls' school for at least a year, so I did. I went to a private girls' school for a year. Ended up going for 2 years because they wanted me to come back, and I did. I decided to go back. But by that time, I had started smoking pot. That was like, let's see, I graduated from high school in 1965, so I had started smoking pot that year. And met a bunch of people and did different things and had already, you know, I didn't know how weird I was, but I knew I was different. Always had been a little, you know, I mean, there was only beatniks first. There weren't hippies, you know, for quite a while. It was beatniks. And I remember people telling me about a place that we should go. We should, called Antioch College in Ohio. Is it in Ohio? Yeah, it's in Ohio. And so I told my parents that I was going to spend the summer with a friend in Birmingham, Michigan. She went to the private girls' school that I went to, and she lived in Birmingham. And the idea was that my boyfriend at the time wanted to dodge the draft, and we had a couple other friends that wanted to do the same thing. So we all hitchhiked, got to Antioch, and dropped acid for the first time. And so the world changed. Everything was different from then on. We ended up hitchhiking to Detroit because we wanted to get across the border to get into Canada where he would be free from the draft, and just never left. We were walking down the street and some people, it was just me and my boyfriend at that point. The other people, I don't know where they went. They were gone somewhere, but we were walking down the street in downtown Detroit, and we must have looked like hippies, you know. And some people drove up in a car and got out and said, oh, you need to go to the artist workshop, because that's where, you know, you'll be comfortable and you'll meet some people that'll help take care of you. So we went there, and I just never left. You know, that's where I met John and Lenny and Pon and everybody. And I never left. My boyfriend did. He went back down. It was down south where we were from. So he went back, and I stayed there. And then it was, I just never left, you know. So
when you got there and, you know, presumably you all started talking about your ideals, your beliefs, were you feeling like you were right already there?
Well, not really. I mean, at first it was just a cultural thing. You know, when you think of culture is what? The clothes you wear, the food you eat, the music you listen to, the, you know, how you look, what you think about, you know, and no, we didn't talk a lot. It was just a bunch of people getting together, and they would put out poetry books that they mimeographed, literally put on a mimeograph machine and stapled together. And, you know, different people from around the country were heard about John because he had been busted. And you know, a lot of people, I think, were the political and the cultural lines had not come together at that point. It was pretty much totally cultural. And yet they kept attacking us, and we had to find out, well, why? You know, it was very strange that they would attack us so hard for being looking different, you know, this is a free country. You know, what does that mean? You know, I mean, it was so strange that it was like we were pushed into being political. We hadn't planned on it. We didn't mean to be, but it was, or at least that's how I felt about it, you know, that we were literally pushed into it. And the Black Panthers contacted us, I think, because I can't even remember now. Did they contact us or we contacted them? But they had similar problems, you know, and that they were being attacked, and you couldn't count on any authorities to help you because they were the ones that were attacking you. And also it was, we had enormous amounts of esteem, you know, and for the Black Panthers because of what they were doing, especially the programs they did, you know, free breakfast for children, just taking care of their community, you know, and try and policing it themselves even, you know, because they knew the police weren't going to help them, so they had to learn how to police it themselves. They were kind of a model in a way for us, although to think of being, you know, the White Panthers, it hadn't it just hadn't occurred to us. It wasn't something we were about until we were kind of pushed into it. We had to protect ourselves, you know. So it wasn't political at first. It was pretty much cultural. It was hippies getting together, playing music, going to the park. We ate different food. We got, you know, we became very aware, you know, the concept of what you are, what you eat, you know, made so much sense, you know, when you, that's what makes your body is what you eat, you know, but there was no such thing as ecology. There was no word ecology. There was no, nobody had ever thought about it. In that sense, you know, I mean, the oceans were vast enough that we could dump stuff into them for the rest of eternity and it would never affect it, is the feeling, you know, that big business still has to this day, you know, I think, you know, to some degree. You know, and how to bring children up in a school, how to make a school interesting and fun and not just, you know, a bunch of rote learning was a new concept, you know, had never been. I mean, well, it wasn't a totally new concept, but it wasn't mainstream, you know, how to, so, you know, and to share things and to actually take care of each other was just not the way things were done. And yet for us, it was all very common and very obvious, you know, and very relaxed. And again, it wasn't until they pushed us into it that we became political and realized that we were going to have to become political to make any kind of real change. And then when the 18-year-old vote came along, that was like this big opportunity. You know, hopefully things would actually change and we'd get people in political office who would be able to define things differently and do things differently. So,
when you were in Detroit, were you living on Warren Forest? Were you living with the other Trans Love Energies folks?
Yep.
What can you describe a little bit about what life was like living there? Like, how did you guys spend your days and...
Well, you know, none of us had jobs in a way, so it was like trying to figure out how to make enough money to pay the rent and get some food. And the Fifth Estate newspaper was right downstairs from us, so we would go out and hawk it on the streets and make a little bit of money to go buy some yogurt or something to eat, you know. it was a nice life. I mean, I remember it really well. I loved living there. It was an upstairs apartment right on the corner. I'm sure you've seen pictures of it probably. Yeah, it was, and everybody had their own rooms and, we tried to stay out of each other's way and help each other as much as we could. And, you know, Lenny had Celia or, Sonny at that point, right? Sonny had just been born. So there was a baby that we all tried to help with and, you know, in a way, you know, to help take care of. And, it wasn't a huge place, but let's see, Grimshaw was there with Judy, his first wife, right? And then it was me and Pun, and there was another guy, and God, I can't remember his name. there was Lenny and John, and I don't know, maybe one or two other people, and then other people would come and go, but and I wasn't there from the beginning. In the beginning, I lived on the street for a while. So, you know, I just stayed where I could and where I could find places. But they were always there at the artist workshop. And then eventually Pun and I met and started hanging out. And that's when I moved in there. So,
Pun sort of describes his role there as he was sort of a jack of all trades. Like whatever needed to be done,
yeah,
he would do it. Is that sort of what were doing
absolutely
as well?
He was like John's right-hand man. You know, he was there to take care of anything or do anything they needed doing. And they'd started working with the bands, you know, so that's where the primary income came from was, well, is that true? Not primary, but that was the major part of it was the bands and how to develop that. But yeah, Pun was like John's right-hand man.
Had the police harassment already, was that already in place by the time you were there? Were they already in the habit of being harassed by the police?
Yeah, or? Pretty much, because of John and his situation at Wayne State and as the, you know, the professor poet who got caught with pot. And you know, back then, pot was still considered, well, it still is with some people, but it was still considered a addictive drug that was, you know, thrown in with heroin and everything else, you know, so it was very scary for people, I think. You know, there was just starting to be a whole group of people that was starting, you know, thinking a different way, you know. So yeah, the police were very aware of us. And there wasn't, I don't remember a lot from the police in those days, but there was a definite consciousness and awareness of them. There was probably more trouble from just people off the street, you know, that would get angry at us and throw rocks at the windows and, you know, yell slurs and say things. That got kind of scary sometimes.
This is moving ahead a little bit, but I got the impression when I read Pun's book that by the time you get to Ann Arbor, obviously things had changed. It had escalated. Things were much more – I mean, you were there because of the police, and it was very much more
politicized. Yeah, because the riots. I mean, when the riots happened, that's changed everything.
Were you in Detroit for the riots?
I was. That's the year that I came.
John has made much about the – outlandish and outrageous and theatrical element of and the humor behind a lot of what the White Panthers stood for literally in the manifesto and such. But I gained the sense reading the book that you and David Sinclair were very much more serious and much more grounded. And I'm just curious if that's a true perception or if you...
Oh, boy. Serious and grounded. That's hard to think of what we were like then, but it is true to a certain extent. I mean, we were very serious about wanting this to be the free country that it was, you know, touted and told to be, that we should have been able to come in and we weren't hurting anyone. I mean, probably the only law we were breaking was smoking pot, and I don't know if LSD was even illegal at that point. I don't know. Probably it was. We weren't breaking lots of laws. That was the main thing. It was just that we were so different and so culturally scary, threatening, you know, to so many people. So on the one hand, yeah, it was very serious. It was very clear in our minds. But serious about what? Serious about having fun, leading a great life and having it be more free and more easy for people to be who they were. And I mean, you know, I have a thing that for me that I always say to people, if you don't understand the 50s, you'll never understand the 60s. And the 50s were so regimented. Everything before then was so incredibly regimented. And you had to fit in. I mean, being from a high-ranking military family, you know, I was the colonel's daughter. You know, I had to act a certain way and be a certain way and look a certain way and go through all that. And yet at the same time, I would always come home and change and put on what I wanted to put on and do what I wanted to do and go off. And it was like a schizophrenic life. So if you didn't understand the 50s, you could never really understand why it was so incredibly, I hate to be so trite, but mind-blowing, you know, for so many people that we changed things. And we still are. I mean, the world changed. We did change the world. I don't care what anybody says. We did. And for the better. It's still happening. It's still, there's a lot of problems created, a lot of misunderstandings happening. Like with sex was one of the biggest misunderstandings and problems to this day. Food, you know, just all kinds of stuff. But yeah, we were very serious on the one hand. On the other hand, when you think about what were we serious about, we were serious about having fun, you know, and enjoying ourselves and creating that kind of a different culture that would change things enough for people. So it's a, I'm being a little ambiguous, but it's, yeah, we were real serious. But on the other hand, it was a lot of fun. We laughed a lot. We had a good time putting it all together.
I noticed that you had, you'd gone to North Vietnam and you came back with a clear view of how the people there felt about the distinction between the Nixon administration and the American people. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about how that affected you and what you brought back.
Oh, going to Vietnam, I could cry right now. It was incredible. It was so different than what I thought it would be. And I went with two other girls, right? There were three of us invited by the North Vietnamese to come there as the alternate youth group, you know, that would come there and see it. And there were several things that stuck out in my mind, okay? One was how much we were greeted and welcomed by everyone everywhere we went, and they knew we were American, and they knew that my father had been over there bombing, and, you know, they knew all that, and yet they treated us so well and so welcoming, and they taught us a lot. They talked about how usually or very often the people of a country are very different than the government of a country. They're different things, and I hadn't really thought about it like that before. But they really did talk about that, and how, and that the, and yet in their country, the people and the government both were trying for peace and wanted friendship with our country and wanted. I mean, we met some high level people. I remember walking in. We let's see, who was it? Oh, geez, what is his name? Was he Laotian or Cambodian? Or he was a very high level, and we walked into a room. We'd been invited to come and meet him and talk, and we walked into a room, and there was probably maybe 10 people in the room, and they were all sitting around talking with each other. You know, I mean, you walked in, and you couldn't, I mean, I just figured they were just all people and that they would bring in this guy eventually, right? Well, when we walked in, they all sort of took their places, so to speak, and there were waiters and waitresses, and there was this, who was he? But anyway, when everybody took their place, we realized that it's like there was no distinctions between them. They all knew each other. They all talked. They all treated each other very well. They didn't wear different clothes even particularly. They just had, you know, there was a couple of translators. There was a couple of aides and you know, and then there were the waiters and the waitresses or the attendants, you know, that went around and brought us tea and whatever. And it was like, wow, you would never see that here, ever, never see that here. You would never walk into a room and not be able to tell immediately who was important and who wasn't and who was just an ordinary person and who, you know, you can pretty much tell when you look around a room, but there you couldn't. And that really just blew me away, you know, in terms of how it could be. I mean, in this country, for me, I always use garbage people as an example, garbage men, because they're usually out the muscle to do it. Think where we would be without garbage men. I mean, we should have them on a pedestal. You know, they should be, you know, paid really well, and, you know, they take care of us, you know. Another thing was driving along and noticing the hilly land, you know, and it was so beautiful. We were there at a beautiful, it was May, it was beautiful. And suddenly realizing that this had been a completely bombed out area is why it was all hilly like that. You know, it had been bombed for miles and miles. And it was green because vegetation had started to come back, but the jungle was gone. And at first it was like, well, we're just going through the country, you know, and maybe they grew some crops here or something. And then slowly it dawned. And I remember looking over at probably Judy and Nancy and saying, this has been bombed. That's what this is, you know, and just wanting to cry, you know, to realize how much of this area. So that blew me away. You know, to see that, how much we had destroyed their country. And then just traveling, going up into the mountains and seeing the different cultures that they allowed to maintain their own cultural identities, not trying to assimilate them, but to have them live their own lives.
How was your trip received when you came back, and were your parents supportive?
The funniest part was coming back was going through Moscow and being followed by the KGB. That was hilarious. They were pretty obvious, and I don't know if they knew that. They were anybody, a man in a dark green suit. There was like five of them, you know, and they were following us, and they'd see us, and they'd look away, and they'd do the magazine thing, you know. I mean, it was straight out of the movies. It was hilarious, and we would play, you know, we'd walk down the street quickly, and they'd follow us, and then we'd stop all of a sudden and turn around, and they'd duck behind the building, or, you know, it was like, good Lord, do they really not know? You know, then later I thought, they must have, maybe they were doing that on purpose to scare us or something, you know, to make us feel scared, but I don't think so. I think they really were that incompetent. You know, they really did not know how to do that, you know. So they were trying to scare us, and it didn't work at all. We couldn't care less, you know. We knew that we'd get back and come back. And when we came back, I'm trying to remember what all was going on. There seemed like there was so much else going on, it almost disappeared that we'd been there. You know, it was weird for a while, but I don't remember anything being said about it, and there was so much else going on. It's like coming right back into the fire, you know, and just getting back into it. And I mean, we dug the crater. I don't know if you
I was gonna ask you about that.
Yeah, that was fun. You know, and I always felt kind of guilty that I'd never really written a book or written more articles or done something, you know, to be more vocal about having been in Vietnam. But
and your family through all this?
Well, that was kind of funny. That was strange. I mean, they lived in Atlanta, so it's a long way away. And we were not very close family, I'll be honest. We were not a very close family. So, I mean, it was years before I even saw them again. And my mother came up to visit one time, but my father never did. And there was a time, it was, I can't remember, I think it was the CIA went to visit them and tried to scare them. Oh, where is she? You tell us where she is. And, you know, and they both told me, I remember them telling me, they said, how ridiculous was that? Everyone knew where you were. You know, there was no question where you were. Why? They were trying to scare them for some reason, but then nobody ever knew why. I mean, why were they doing that? I mean, who cared? You know, so they, in a way, they supported me, but we were just not very close, you know, so it wasn't a real factor.
So did that make the houses on Hill and the relationship that you had with everybody there, did you feel very much like this was your family?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, very definitely. Yeah, much more so than my real family at the time. You know, I mean, it was, like I said, we were not a close family. So it was really nice to meet a bunch of people that we felt so much alike and, you know, liked each other and had a lot of fun together and worked hard to keep the house going and all of that. So, yeah, that was very much of a family.
Can you describe sort of typical days in the Hill Street houses? Were there typical days in the Hill Street houses?
You had asked me earlier for a typical day, and I'm going, honey, I mean, no, you know, there's not a typical day. I mean, everybody got up when they wanted to. I mean, so there'd be people that would have been out all night and up all night and would get up in the afternoon. And I mean, especially with the band, you know, if you work with a band, you wouldn't get back till 4 or 5 in the morning, you know, so we'd sleep till noon or, you know, and then get up and just be around Ann Arbor, you know, walk around and talk, see people. And, I don't know if there was a typical day. I mean, it depends on what part of the era you're talking about too. I mean, when John was in prison, it was a constant, you know, trying to make people aware of him and figure out how to get him out. And Pun, you know, same way, you know, how are you going to get him out? How do you keep in touch with him? Rallies, benefits, you know, constantly trying to, I mean, John really had a real good consciousness of how to use culture to raise money and to try to get support, you know. So we would have benefits lots of times, you know, different places we would go with bands, our bands as well as other bands. I mean, if you go way back, then there was the Grandy, you know, so we built the Grandy pretty much. So there were times when we would go over to the Grandy Ballroom every day and paint and clean and, you know, do stuff over there. And then there were kids, you know, we had Celia, we had Una, who was Frank and Peggy's daughter. We had Sonny and Celia, and sometimes there were other kids that would come over, so we'd be taking care of kids, you know, and getting them the stuff they needed and making food, and never enough food, always having battles over food. I remember John one time put a lock on the refrigerator. Because somebody would always come and drink all the orange juice, you know, and he would get so mad. So, and everybody was so upset, you know. I mean, we're growing kids, you know, and growing people. We need our food. And so it was that was a constant battle, you know, trying to get enough food for everybody. And then there were the paper, you know, putting out the papers and putting out the poetry books and, you know, being in contact with different people around the country to set up different things and bring different people in. So a daily day was, you know, it was different all the time what you did when you got up. I mean, the house and the location is what made it stable, you know, to have the two houses and I mean, when we first moved in, well, not when we first moved in, but after a while, we painted the whole things on the, you know, both houses on the outside to match. That was a big project we undertook, you know, to paint and to try to make it nice and keep it nice, relatively. And, yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, a typical day.
Have your beliefs and convictions changed much since those days? How, if you had to go back, what would you do the same? What would you do different?
I don't think my beliefs have changed. I mean, if anything, I've become more convinced of where we were coming from and why it was so important and how it changed the world. So, yeah, I still feel very much the same. How I would have changed it? How could you have? I mean, there was no examples for us to look at, you know, of how to do anything like that, really. We made a lot of mistakes, I'm sure. I know we did a lot of stupid things. And I mean, being young kids, at the time we were young kids, we didn't know really how to do stuff, so we bungled along, you know, doing what we could. I don't know if I would have changed a whole lot, just because I tend to think that way about life. I mean, a lot of regrets. Yeah, I have a lot of regrets. But to change, go back and change things, I don't know. Because then how do you predict what would have happened then? You know, if you change anything, everything changes. And we had to go through what we went through to learn what we learned. You know, I've never really thought like that. What would I change if I went back to change? I mean, I'm sure there are things. You know, I probably would have tried to help Pun a lot more than I did because he was an alcoholic, right? And I couldn't help him at all. So I probably would have tried to help him more. I mean, it's true of any life.
Yeah.
Your life, you know, when you look back at your life, what would you change? You know, I mean, you'd probably have regrets, things that you can remember that you feel, oh, I wish I hadn't done that, or oh, I wish I hadn't said that, or something. But to really change it, you know, and not have done it, what would it have done to your life, and what would you not have learned, or, you know? So in a way, I hesitate to really want to change anything. Mm-hmm. Although, if I really sit here and think about it for a long time, I'll probably come up, yeah, we should have done this and this and this. You know, we could have done it that way instead.
At the time, like at the time of the White Panther Party, what did you feel were the end goals? Like if you could have achieved what you wanted to achieve, what would that achievement have been?
You know, I'm one of those really big idealists. So when you ask me that, you know, John had a phrase one time. And I don't know where he got it. I'm not sure where he got it, but who said this? It was probably somebody like Sun Ra or something said, everything's on the planet already. It's all here. So it's a matter of distribution. How do you take care of everybody? If you care about people and if you care about life, you want to have things not all the same and not everybody be the same and not everything exactly the same for everybody. But you want everybody happy and taken care of and the bottom line, food, clothing, shelter, at least, so that you have a positive attitude all over the whole world. I mean, how can that be bad, you know? In a way, I look at it kind of like unions. I'm not against unions. I'm not for unions. I'm for them when you need them. When you need a union, they're good because they come in and they deal with owners that aren't taking care of the people that are working. So you set up laws and regulations and you try to deal with them. But when the unions go into a place where everybody's taken care of and it's good and people don't really need it, then you're getting into just self whatever. You know, they're just taking care of themselves and trying to make money and push people around. So if you kind of look at the world that way, we need unions, you know, all over the world to make sure that everybody gets taken care of and everybody has at least food, clothing, shelter, some education, decent water, and start there. T- to have that kind of an opportunity. So that, I mean, think of all the people all over the world who are just being completely wasted. Their talents are completely wasted because nobody even knows they exist. You know, all the kids that are out there that have enormous potential for all kinds of stuff to, you know, in science and education and everything. And we're sort of taking back steps now with, like, food and how many chemicals we use. And, you know, people are actually starting to see that this is maybe not the best way to handle things, you know. And it isn't all packaged foods isn't the best way to go. And believe, you know, they really believed that that was true for a long time. They tried it, but it isn't true. So, you know, in the biggest sense, yeah, take care of. There's no reason not to take care of the whole planet, especially, you know, I mean, we've got the consciousness now of the whole planet. We're not just living in completely isolated situations. I mean, there are lots of isolated situations, but on purpose, you know, at least they know about it and other people are leaving them alone more than unknown isolation. There is some, I'm sure. I know there is. But for the most part, if there was that kind of a consciousness, we could go in and bring fresh water and figure out ways for people to learn how to grow their own food and to, I mean, communities to grow food and to take care of themselves and to educate their kids and to be happy and to, I mean, and in the end, that is what we were looking for. You know, how do you do things differently? And, but at the beginning, it was more like, okay, we're a group of people who want to do things differently than the way we were brought up with. So just let us do our thing. Let us have our schools. Let us grow our food or at least distribute the food we want. We had food co-ops, you know, we used to, you know, all that kind of stuff. Let us wear the clothes we want, listen to the music we want to listen to, and try to be compatible. I sort of still feel that way now that, oh, people are so different. There's so many different kinds of people in the world. You need, if there's true democracy and decentralization, which I'm for both. So you have like Las Vegas. I mean, they've voted and they've got legalized prostitution, legalized all kinds of stuff there where it's not legal in other places, but they voted it in there. Well, that's good. Well, there ought to be whole cities, and they're starting to be now, where marijuana is legal, you know, and where people can go and live that kind of life, you know, and you pick where you want to go and do what you want to do based on who you are, not your family or not anybody else, but who you grow up to be. So, and I, you know, I'm big enough of an idealist to believe that it can be done. Whether it ever will or not, who knows? But I guess somebody's got to think that way. So in a way, you know, the biggest picture is, yeah, take care of everybody and make sure people, I mean, if somebody wants to be a prude, I hate to use the word, but if they want to be a prude and be very tight-knit and very, you know, staid and, you know, wear turtlenecks all the time and, you know, I mean, they should be able to do that, you know, and have a community of like that, that is okay with that, you know, and nobody looks down on it or frowns on it. And I don't mean to segregate all the communities either. People need to, you know, interact and know each other. But if there's true democracy, people set up their own communities and their own cities and their own villages the way they want them and do it that way.
Was the conscious decision to change the name of the party from the White Panthers to the Rainbow People, was that part of it? Was the, a desire to go back to, you know, the more basic beliefs, or
well, we were really attacked. They started shooting people. I mean, when they started shooting people, I mean, like Ohio State or Kent State, you know, a lot of people backed off at that point and said, "Whoa, this isn't what we signed up for." You know, we were weekend hippies or something. You know, a lot of, for most people were. You know, they were just having fun on the weekends and trying to, you know, do something different and being part of this big movement that was going on. So yeah, we, at that point we needed to broaden, you know, to get even bigger. And we'd always studied Indian culture, you know, that was a real, real close part of what we based our whole approach on, was the tribal consciousness, that kind of awareness. And that's where the Rainbow People came from. That was one of the legends, right? So it was, Yeah, I don't know that it was going back so much as it was going forward, is how I felt about it. And I think we did. I think most of us at that point, some people might have thought we were going backwards because we'd been so political, you know, and then we had to back off. But in a way, it was going forward because it was trying to involve more people and get it to be easier for people to relate to and not quite so dangerous because they were, you know, they were killing people at that point. You know, I remember having that conversation about why to get involved in local politics like that, to that extent, to actually run for office. And up until that point, everybody kept saying, and especially the Human Rights Party at that point, had kept saying that they were doing this to educate people, to get the word out and to get things going and to inform people and educate them. But for us, it was like, it was more serious. It was like, if we're going to run for office, we're going to try to get that office, and we're going to actually try to run it and do the business and take care of things and change it and try to make things more kind to people. You know, I remember talking about the sheriff's office always having to go in and evict people and just throwing them out on the street with all their stuff. Well, instead of doing that, helping find people find someplace else, help them move their stuff, you know, make it more humane, a more humane government. So we were very conscious of, if we were going to get involved like that we wanted it to be for real. Well, we were in a precinct. I mean, where we ran me, we were in a precinct that was heavily Republican, or at the time, wasn't it? Right? Oh, boy, now I can't even remember. We were accused of splitting the vote. Well, that's what it was, too. They had just reapportioned, I think, too, and there was a chance that the Democrats would be able to win that particular area, and we went in and split the vote. And I barely knew what that meant, even. And I remember being yelled at a few times going around in the community, in the neighborhoods, and people yelling at me and being really angry at me, and me having to go back and find out, why are they so mad that they would run me for office, you know? And that's exactly what they said. We did split the vote. We did very well, but we did split the vote, and the Republicans won. Oh, well, you know, I mean, but in the meantime, it at least did raise consciousness for people about what it meant to have more parties than just the Democrats and the Republicans. So we're sort of still in that position now, but sorry, it didn't change that much, right? But it did some. So we were serious about, you know, actually wanting to win and take over the office, if any offices, if we got on city council or anything, that we would actually try to do a good job, you know, and make things happen.
When did things sort of start to fall apart at the Hill Street houses?
At the Hill Street houses, when John went into prison. I mean, he really was the guiding light, you know, of what we did. And we had to spend so much time then trying to get him out of prison. Oh, and the band was, it was a very strange situation with the band because they were being lured by New York, you know, the big record companies. So that their concern was, well, what are we going to do as a band now? Not what are we going to do as a group, or how are we going to get John out of prison or anything. It was just, well, what are we going to do as a band now? So that kind of threw everybody for a loop. We all kind of, you know, bad attitude, you know, wrong way to think. But so it kind of started to fall apart in a way then.
And then when John was released from prison, did things start to refocus a little bit?
Yeah, but it was so torn apart at that point. The whole country was. You know, it wasn't just us. It was everybody. It was unclear where things were going and what was going to happen. You know, there was a point when Pun and I left. We had an old, I think it was a 49 Ford truck. It was a really cool truck. And we built a wooden house on the back of it and got an old potbelly stove, literally. I mean, it was, and drove around the country. It was fun. People would wave at us and, you know, follow us and everything. And because, and we Oh, we went into the woods and we found some antlers. So we put these, we had huge, probably 12-point antlers on the front of the truck on the top. You know, so, I mean, we were hippies, totally. You know, anybody would look at it. Kids would just be, wow, you know, in cars going by, you know. They'd wave and honk their horns and everything. It was fun. But we left after, you know, when they killed Martin Luther King. In 68, that sort of ruined stuff a lot. We were still living in Detroit. That's when we moved to Ann Arbor, right? It was when they did that. And then when after we left, I'm trying to remember what happened. I mean, it was, God, was John still in prison? Do you remember? Was John out?
He was out then.
He was out. And I'm trying to remember why we decided to leave. It was falling apart. I think we were losing the houses. We weren't quite sure what was going to happen. And we both said, look, we'll make things easier. We'll leave and go do something else for a while, you know, and you guys figure out what's going to go on, basically, you know, and someday we'll come back, you know, and see if we can help. And everybody was cool with that because it was just all so unclear at that point where anybody was going to go and what we were going to do. So we left. And we were gone for quite a while. I don't remember how long, but it was a while.
One of the people that, of course, we would have liked to interview is David Sinclair, but we can't. And we've been asking for, you know, sort of a character sketch. And I was just – you talked about him a little, but I wondered if you'd mind telling us some of your thoughts about
David. Oh, no.
David
was a wonderful person. He's one of the most wonderful, kind, intelligent, caring, hardworking, fun. I mean, he was a true wonderful person, just a truly wonderful person. You could count on David anytime you needed him to talk or to take care of business or to help somebody. David was there always. He was just always right there. And, you know, you wondered, was he in the shadow of his brother, you know? And that never, I don't think that was ever talked about or even thought about. He was so much of his own person and clearly doing what he wanted to do, you know? He was not, there was no resentment or anything on his part at all. He was a truly wonderful person. Yeah, I have nothing but good things to say about David. We all did. I don't know, everybody would say, we call him Dave more than David, but... At the time, anyway. Can't remember. But, yeah, he was a really good person.
How about Gary?
Grimshaw? Grimshaw was Grimshaw, you know. Grimshaw was the artist. You know, he was very focused, very, very focused on what he had to do. And you would rarely even see him. You know, he wasn't around a lot. He was like the mole in the corner over there, drawing, you know, doing his... He was really... and I say mole, I mean mole in the sense of an animal that is underground, you know. It's not. But he was fun, too. He was always fun and you know, did his part and much more practical than you would think. But he was very much the artist, very much the artist. You know, in the sense that he just didn't care about a lot else. That's what his role was, to illustrate it, you know, to show it and to make it bigger and prettier, you know, somehow. So he was the artist. He just was always the artist.
How about Lenny?
Lenny was the rock. Lenny was the rock. Lenny was always the one who was the most practical in terms of day-to-day living, food, keeping the house together, making sure the washing machine worked, you know, taking care of the kids, ordering us around, you know, making sure everybody knew what they were supposed to be doing. She was always a rock. And well, I don't know. If you know her now, you wouldn't maybe not know that or wouldn't think of her that way. But she was, for the rest of us, you know. She was the den mother, you know, the house mother, the one who was very clear. She was John's wife, you know, and John was the head of the family, and she was also the head of the family. You know, they were the two heads of the family, and the mother and the father. She's got a lot of information, right? And she can put things together. She understands, you know, the relationship between things and why this happened and why that happened and, you know, how it relates, you know, to think that, you know, she'll tell you how it was us that brought down Nixon, right? Did she tell you? But yeah, you know, and who would think that? You know, who would ever be able to have that much relative consciousness to figure it all out, you know, unless you sat down and went, okay, this is what happened. Once you hear it from her, it's like, oh yeah, okay, we did. You know, that's how it worked. If it hadn't gone down that way, who knows what would have happened? You know, it would have been completely different if it hadn't gone down that way. So she has helped me understand a lot of stuff. We talk sometimes, you know, and I'll just ask her, what did we do? You know, and what was that about? And, you know, why were we doing that? And you know, and she'll make it all real clear. So, yeah, she still is, you know, very politically astute. I think of her as that way, you know, very politically astute, understands a lot of stuff.
Pun?
Oh, yeah. The love of my life. Pun. Yeah, he was, oh, man. You'd say almost call him the heart of the whole thing, you know. I mean, he just had so much heart and was so big of a personality and worked so hard, just would be willing to do anything. And he would go with the band sometimes, and a lot of the times he'd go with the bands, but he'd always be there for John, and he'd, you know, make sure that he was there so that if John needed something done, he would do it, you know, and take care of business. And everybody loved Pun, you know. He was easy to talk to and fun, and it was just, we had a nice relationship, you know, the two of us. We were joined at the hip, everybody said. We were joined at the hip. We were always together and always did a lot together. Not everything, but we did a lot together. But he was a real anchor, too, you know, for the whole thing, until it fell apart, you know, and then it fell apart.
While we're on a roll, David Fenton.
Oh. You'll get a bunch of stuff from him that you won't get from anybody else, probably. You know, and that's a good thing. You know, he'll bring up some things that you may want to call a few people back, you know, and say, I heard this. Is this true? You know, was it really like that? You know, he had a little bit of a different perspective on some of the things that happened, I know. So he'll be interesting. But he was very clear on what was going on and how we were affecting things and what our place was in the political arena at the time, and was very respectful that way of what we were doing and where it was going. So, but he went through some things, so it'll be interesting. It'll be an interesting interview, yeah.
You mentioned the relationship to the Nixon regime falling apart. Was it surprising to discover that the Justice Department was interested in what you were doing on Hill Street, that the Justice Department had informants and...
Oh, you know, it was amazing. You know, it was, in a way, by that time, it wasn't as surprising to us as I think it would have been to other people. It was very surprising to think that they would care about this little group in Michigan. You know, I mean, what in the world? I remember picking up the phone one time in Ann Arbor and to make a call, and I could hear conversations going on in a completely other part of the house that we weren't anywhere near, you know, listening and going, how come I'm hearing a conversation in another part of the house in this phone? You know, and it occurred to me they'd messed up their bug somehow. You know, they'd messed it up. Who knows how? But, and so I said something to them. You know, I said, you're messing this up. I'm hearing, you know, and I'm talking away. And I put it down and waited a while and came back, and then it was fine. You know, but it was, you know, and then going to my parents in Atlanta saying, you know, where is your daughter? You know, I mean, by the time they were doing that kind of stuff, it was like, and again, that was why we got... backed off a little bit too. You know, it was like they're literally killing people. They were killing Black Panthers. They were infiltrating different places and setting people up in situations that they would not, you know, entrapment, setting people up in situations that they wouldn't. But we knew we were, by that time, we were pretty threatening too. And so in a way there was a, I don't want to say pride, but in a way there was, we were kind of proud of what we had done, that they would care that much about us, you know, and be that aware of what we were doing. So it was, you know, when we put it, I'm trying to remember the first time Lenny said something to me about how it was us that brought down the Nixon administration. That surprised me. You know, I had forgotten that it was that clearly of a lineage, like, you know, of what had happened. But it was true, you know. So it's strange that it could have been this little group that did as much as we did and almost disappeared.
You had a role in providing security for some of the concerts and events, and yeah. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about...
Oh, the Psychedelic Rangers.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Psychedelic Rangers. Well, it went along with all the other cultural approach. You know, we wanted to take care of ourselves. You know, we wanted to do things our way, you know, rather than do the way they had always been done. And I think a big part of it was making that distinction in drugs, the good drugs and the bad drugs. You know, for us, marijuana and the psychedelics and the natural drugs were all considered to be educational, good, spiritual, you know, good additions to people's lives that could help you, you know, and do things. Whereas speed and what was the other big one? Oh, Quaaludes, however people say it, you know, any, you know, heroin. Cocaine was on the border because it was so much fun, but it was very expensive. And, you know, I never bought cocaine ever in my life. You know, the only time I did it was because we were around so many musicians and they would have it and share, you know. So, but we were so clear on wanting to police our own situations, and we made the arrangements with the Ann Arbor police, you know, that we told them. I'm pretty sure we told them outright that's what we were going to do, that we were not going to turn people in for marijuana and for psychedelics, but they would not be allowed to sell it, you know, or to distribute it anywhere, but we were not going to stop people from using. But we would stop people, and we would turn people in. I don't know if we said we would turn them in, but we said we would at least run them off. We wouldn't let them stay if they were using bad drugs or trying to sell drugs or do anything like that. So, so then it's just a matter of organization. You know, you get a bunch of people, you have an area, you grid it off, and you're in here, you're here, you're here, you're here. Pay attention, you know, and look around and make sure that we catch what's going on and actually do it, because if we don't, they're not going to let us, you know, do it ourselves if we didn't actually do it. And we did. So it was fun.
Do you have specific memories of the Free John rally?
Yeah. The 10 for 2. Wasn't it?
I guess it was.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I remember. Yeah. I remember walking in and seeing John Lennon and Yoko Ono, you know, sitting there together, you know. And that's actually my major memory from that. And then just the enormous amount of people. And they started to sort of crowd up to the stage at one point, and we had to really work hard to get them back, because it was crushing, literally crushing people, you know. They had to get back. But it was a lot of fun. It was fun. It was interesting. I remember being surprised that people were so surprised that John Lennon and Yoko Ono came to support John Sinclair. You know, that people were very surprised that they would do that. It was like shocking, you know, but not for us. We were like, phew, it's about time. You know, they need to be here, you know, to do this. It's part of everything that's going on. So it was a lot of fun. It was huge. It was a huge success. And it worked.
So what was next for you after all of this political action and everything that you'd been involved with? Where'd you go next?
We had been to several different houses. We got a house downtown in the New Center area of Detroit. We had a very nice house, a huge house. But I remember it being very confusing of what we were going to do, and I had no idea what I was going to do. I didn't know what I was going to do or where I was going to go. I just stayed with John and Lenny because I'd been with them, and Frank and Peggy, and all the kids. And I think that's all it was John and Lenny and Frank and Peggy, the kids and me. And I remember not knowing what I was going to do and meeting Ed Lamb, who was a photographer. And I don't know how he met Lenny, but he and Lenny were really good friends. And he and I started hanging out and going out together. And he was a producer, closed circuit producer, like for training and educational things. And he was a photographer for the Legal News. So he would go around and take pictures. And he did some pictures, I think, probably for Lenny. You know, because her being a photographer, they had a lot in common. And he and I became really good friends. And I moved out and moved in with him and started learning about production. And I spent about the next 10 years of my life learning television production and wrote scripts and learned all about, you know, and ended up shooting. I shot and I directed a few spots. We would do things for the car companies and for the hospitals. And I learned a lot. And that was fun. You know, there was an organization, Detroit Producers Association, that we got involved in, and I started putting out a newsletter for them, and that turned into a magazine and started making a living from the magazine then for a while. And then I started training Tai Chi. I'd always been such a wild child, you know, that any kind of martial arts was what I was hoping would sort of discipline me, you know, bring me into some kind of more discipline to be more effective, you know, in life. So, and then Ed and I had trouble. We were together like 13 or 14. Was it that long? Something like that. Yeah, I think it was 13 years. And we'd been on and off. I mean, it wasn't real easy, but we had a good life together. But then I fell in love with somebody. I fell in love with my Tai Chi teacher, actually. I hate to say it that way, but it's true. I did. So I moved in with him and started teaching. I didn't mean to teach. I didn't mean to make that what I was going to do, but it turned out that way. They started asking me to teach. And it's a very legitimate, it's one of the five families in China. In China, there are five families that teach Tai Chi. So he was a disciple of the family. It's a martial art discipleship. So then I became a disciple of the family, met the family, I've been to China several times, and I'm still a disciple of the family. And now I teach Tai Chi full time. So it's a real nice place to be able to help people. I teach all ages of people, not too many young kids, but my youngest is like 15, I think. And my oldest is 95, I think. So it's a good range. So it's not as a political of a situation, but it is helping people. You know, and it's been really good for me. So, and it's another chapter in my life. You know, I was the colonel's daughter, right? And then there was the White Panther, Rainbow People's Party thing, you know, there was all of that. And then there was Ed and the production community. And then there was Steve and the Tai Chi community. And that's where I still am. You know, and the magazine was in there, you know, with Ed. And then by myself doing the magazine after he and I broke up.
Do you teach in Ann Arbor?
Yeah, I have a school in Ann Arbor. Yeah. I teach at the University of Michigan in Dearborn. Botsford Hospital's Wellness Center, Ann Arbor Community Health. I volunteered to do a class there, so we've just started that. So we're going to add, and I've taught a million other places. So
in a way, of all the folks from back then, you're the one that came back to Ann Arbor. You don't look.
I hadn't thought about it that way. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, sort of full circle. Yeah, I've thought about moving back here. You know, it would be nice. But I love where I live now. I live in Royal Oak now, so I love it being there, too. That's fun. But I still may come back to Ann Arbor to live eventually. We'll see.
To learn more about Jeannie Parker, go to freeingjohnsinclair.org.
AADL Talks to Jeannie Parker has been a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.